is the Stargirl After Show with Sarah and Sean. Your post-show breakdown of DC Stargirl with Easter eggs, exclusive behind-the-scenes info, and cast and crew interviews.
This is our destiny.
I finally know who I really am.
I'm Stargirl.
This is the Stargirl After Show.
Hey, Star fam, welcome back to another episode of Stargirl After Show, sponsored as always by Stargirl.tv and DCTV.news, your best resources for news, media, and spoilers about Stargirl and other DC Comics properties. I'm Sean.
And I'm Sarah.
And this week we're talking about Frenemies, Chapter 2, The Suspects.
Dun, dun, dun.
And right at the top, I do want to say this is written by Robbie Hine and directed by Andy Armiganian, and you'll see mostly paired up episodes like that, because this season, like last season, we shot two episodes at a time.
Okay.
So these two are directed by Andy, and then they'll be paired off, except it's an odd number, so obviously at some point there will be a single.
So, bold statement, it's episode two, but I think this is my favorite season so far. I love the murder mystery aspect. I love how this one starts with like going back in time and seeing part of what we've already seen, but then things added to it. And my suspicions and accusing everyone of everything are just off the charts right now. So I apologize for all the wild accusations that I'm going to be making.
Yeah, when they called this episode The Suspects, that was a good title, because pretty much everyone's a suspect.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not our good guys, but
probably, but I've accused them at one point too.
But every one of the former bad guys, air quotes, is brought up as a suspect at one point or another. And actually, you know, we as the viewers are given evidence to back a bunch of those up over the course of the episode.
Yeah. And I feel like there are a lot more suspects that we haven't met yet that were introduced at the end of last season. And so I think there's still more coming.
I mean, it's really laying in the mystery pretty thick.
Yeah.
So let's jump in.
All right. So we jumped to 12 hours ago, and this is when the gambler is arriving at his RV, lucky number 7. One small detail, you know, this is a gambler. Everything is always purple. His shoes were blue, and then the sole was red.
I love those red soles.
That was beautiful. I love that.
I mean, I didn't even put together the blue and red make purple deal that you're pointing out, mm-hmm. but like red soles were just like, I don't know. Sexy.
Weird saying that about the gambler, but yes.
Hey, you know, you see his dance moves, he can get it.
He can, and he is bopping to the music here. He gets his photo out of Becky. He gets that duck that I talked about last episode.
Yep.
So now I'm like, oh, this duck has to be important. I have no idea how, but I'm convinced now.
Did you notice the combination on his suitcase?
No, I didn't catch it. What was it?
777.
That is such an easy combination to break.
Slot machine jackpot, though.
Yeah.
But also, it's like, okay, I've met this guy. I can guess his code.
Yeah.
I want to point out, in this scene, everything he does is just so meticulous.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the way he puts his laptop down, like, everything is so just... meticulous is the only word I have for it. But also, it was kind of strange when he walks in and he looks around this trailer in a trailer park. He kind of looks like he's like, all right, yeah, moving on up.
It is a nice looking trailer, though.
It's a very nice looking trailer, but just a little strange for someone of his former means to have been that excited about it. Wonder where he's been for the last year is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And then we see that Crusher is spying on him from his car. He lifts up his bat. You can see how angry he is. And then he puts it down, deciding better of it. And he drives off. And that's the scene in the first episode we saw where Gambler heard that noise and then rushed out with his gun and then came back in and threw his gun away. And I really like that they are providing the explanation for that scene.
Yeah, though I got to say, if I rushed out of my house with a gun every time I heard some tires squealing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the paranoia that he does or the reason to be paranoid that he does. But I don't know. Maybe don't rush out of your trailer with a gun every time you hear a noise.
No, maybe he needs to start talking to someone about his paranoia.
Except he can't because he's dead.
Well, yeah, now.
Going back to the old phrase, it's not paranoia if they're really out to get you.
It's true. All right. And then we also see that the Shade was there and he pops up inside the RV. And so based on the timeline, we know that this is after, in the first episode, it's after they already talked to each other at the diner.
Yes.
But we don't see what happens there. We jump over to the pit stop where the JSA is meeting minus Cindy.
Because you don't want to invite the suspect to your meeting about how to handle the suspect.
Which Yolanda points out, like, if you truly believe she was innocent, she would be here. And Courtney's a little upset that people aren't really caring that the gambler's dead. But she's like, you know, the point is a man is dead and there's a killer on the loose. Like, it is our job to take care of this.
Yeah. And she has a new piece of evidence or a new insight, which is that his laptop was missing.
Mm-hmm.
So whoever has that laptop must be the killer.
Right. Because it's always straightforward like that.
Well, who else would have had the opportunity to take it?
It's true. But I mean, I don't trust anyone in Blue Valley. So any one of them could have gotten in there. I mean, when did Cindy have the opportunity to take it?
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. She didn't really have a pocket on her.
Though we know he did have it right before he was killed.
Right. So someone had to have come in later to get it, which we know who it was, but could have been anyone. But it did flash back to Cindy's explanation that she went to investigate and then she found the trailer destroyed, gambler dead, and then the gun accidentally went off when she picked it up. But the gambler wasn't shot, so it wasn't like she killed him that way.
Didn't help her look any more innocent holding a smoking gun over a dead body.
And we see in that flashback, Courtney took the letter that gambler wrote to Becky.
Yeah, which she now reads. She seems a little torn about it, but it gives her insight into maybe what gambler's real motives here were, which were what he said they were.
Mm-hmm. And then we see Cindy in the ISA headquarters. I like that she's still using that space, you know, is her work area, her office. And then she's got all these knives and blades and syringes and needles and chemistry stuff going on.
Sarah, let me ask you, if you had access from your home into a network of secret tunnels and a secret meeting room, is there any chance in the world that you would not be utilizing that?
If I was Cindy, I could see it. Me personally would be terrified because the ISA knows about all those entrances. So who's to say who's going to show up there randomly?
I would be down there. I would be utilizing that. I mean, that's free real estate, basically.
I would probably get over it and go down there.
Especially with the ISA all accounted for, really.
Yeah.
They're all either dead or reformed at this point.
Allegedly reformed.
Potentially reformed, yes.
But I'm very curious what Cindy is doing here because she makes some kind of purple liquid. She is looking at the gambler and takes a drink of it. It was established in the first season that she was really good with chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And then her history, like with Dragon King, like that she knows about all that stuff. But I don't know what she would be concocting that would help with this.
And has it already started working on her? Because she winced in pain at one point.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine the changes she's gone through have been painless.
No, I'm sure they aren't. We get a quick shot of Rick visiting where Grundy's buried, still seeing the giant lump in the ground. So he's convinced that Grundy is still there.
And I think he mentions like twice in this episode, like, well, Grundy didn't do this.
He's being very defensive of Grundy, but also he does believe that he's dead, which I don't know. We will see.
Well, he has a right to be defensive given the way the trailer was torn up.
Mm-hmm.
It does, as Sylvester said, seem Grundy-ish.
Yeah, that was my episode one prediction that Grundy was involved in it. Then we go over to Pat finding Courtney in her room, talking about how she's read the gambler's letter a dozen times, really believes he's trying to be better. She wants to find the killer, find Becky, and give her the letter, which Pat is very supportive of. And then he mentions that Sylvester wants to question some of the gambler's old colleagues. So I'm sure that's going to go very well.
Yeah, Courtney's very determined to get justice for the gambler. You know, I think she's in a headspace where, you know, what if this was my dad trying to make amends with me and then he died before he could do so and I was left not knowing how he really felt.
And it is a different situation because who knows Becky even knows about the gambler. if she was adopted, she may not know anything about her birth parents.
She probably doesn't.
And so Courtney is probably just everything that she would like in her life, she is putting on Becky.
But by the same token, you know, Becky probably does wonder what the deal was with her parents.
Yeah, I'm sure she does.
You know, as all adopted kids, I think, tend to.
But is it a kindness to go tell someone who doesn't know about their parents, hey, your dad was responsible for all this bad stuff in the world, but he decided at the end of his life to reform? I'm not sure that I would want to know that.
Is she even necessarily planning on doing that? Or just saying like, hey, your dad found out that you existed and he loved you and wanted to apologize?
I thought he covered some of that in his letter, though.
I think in the letter he said he did bad things.
But he didn't go into why would he go into specifics?
He didn't say like, I shot a truck driver.
Yeah.
With a gun hidden in my sleeve back in season one.
I guess that would be a pretty terrible letter.
I tried with some supervillains to take over America and kill 25 million people. Like that stuff wasn't in there.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, I made mistakes. I wanted to be there for you so that you don't go down the same path I did, is kind of what it says.
All right. And then we go to one of my favorite duos in the show. And we have Mike and Jakeem. They're, you know, getting their papers ready to deliver. And we see a close up on the paper and it says freak tornado leaves one dead with a picture of the RV. And Mike is so excited. He has so much confidence as he's saying, you know, this is the best thing that could happen. And Jakeem is like, a man being dead? He's like, no, a murderer being dead. And because he's like, this is our chance to prove ourselves.
Yeah, I like that they're like doing their own little team thing.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'm wondering is, where is Mike getting all this confidence from? Because it's not from Pat. Pat doesn't talk this way. So is it just him rebelling against Pat?
I think he's been faking it till you make it sort of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that standing your ground, even for a couple of minutes against Eclipso, even with the help of a giant robot, that's confidence building.
It's true. And he also did kill the big bad of season one. So he has done some pretty important things.
But also, we have to consider that, like, maybe throughout his life, Pat's been building Mike's self-esteem.
Yeah.
So that Mike doesn't end up like him.
I could see that. Absolutely. So at the American Dream, Barbara is arriving and all these people are talking about if they heard about Sharp because he used to work there. One woman says, you know, it serves Mr. Sharp right. God rest his soul.
And Beth's dad here is like jumping in on the superhero game, talking about like, oh, we do have freak weather around here. Like, you remember those storms last summer?
Yeah. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, Barb.
The woman, I think her name is Charlotte, that works at the American Dream. She seems dubious about the idea of a tornado touching down in just one spot.
Yeah.
And so he's like helping the cover story.
Mm-hmm. And then this guy, Tim, who the heck is this guy? I hate him more than all the other characters right now.
He is a new manager at the American Dream. And he is basically the Dolores Umbridge of Blue Valley.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. I'm glad I wasn't overreacting to him. Because
he was being mean
to Barb and it was just pissing me off.
Oh, yeah, because he's like got that like I'm your buddy thing, but like I'm also being a super jerk about it.
Yep.
You know what? I take back Dolores Umbridge. He's the Jeremy Jam of Blue Valley.
Oh, Jam.
Yeah, you got jammed.
Oh, he's like a combination of them.
Ugh. Yeah.
All right. Barb makes it into her office, though, and Paul is there with an immediate, we didn't do it.
Yeah.
Because we would never leave the body. Disposing of a corpse is 101. And Barb just goes, don't tell me about that.
And this actually ties up a mystery from season one, this line of dialogue here, because they shot the Fiddler in the Whitmore Dugan house.
Mm-hmm.
And I've wondered, how did that get covered up?
Yeah.
No one questioned an arrow through the heart of the high school principal in the Whitmore Dugan's house. Well, that's because Proc and Paula took the time to dispose of the body properly.
Yeah, exactly. 101.
Or probably stage it as a hunting accident, which is what they said happened to her.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't leave the body there in the living room.
And Paula makes a great argument. we wouldn't risk losing our daughter again. We don't want to go back to jail and lose our daughter. So why would we waste that on the gambler?
Yeah, I love that the Croc's number one motivation here and throughout is family.
Yeah.
We saw that all over season two. They broke out of prison to support their daughter for her scout tryout thing. And just that's what all of this is about for them is family. And yeah, we've seen them murder people, multiple people in cold blood and attempt to murder our heroes. Even, I mean, Paula attempted to murder Barbara.
Yeah.
And, you know, before this season, they'd only met twice. So prior to episode one here, 50% of their interactions were attempted murder.
Mm-hmm.
But this whole focus on family really makes them relatable and makes us buy their rehabilitation.
Yes. And it makes sense that Barbara is helping her. Paula's talking about how she's been trying to fit in, doing everything that you do. I garden, I smile at people, join the Rotary Club. Yeah. And she needs to bake a German chocolate cake and doesn't understand why she can't just buy it. Barbara is explaining like, oh, well, it's special when you put in your personal time. And Paula just goes, interesting. Baking makes people think you care. I mean, I do care. And then gives her a little Paula smile.
I like that Paula's kind of like an alien.
Yeah.
Like she just legitimately does not understand human social interactions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, however did her and Croc even get together?
I think she's learning, though. But we'll get to that later on in here. First, we go back to the JSA cafeteria table. We learn that they determined that the gambler was killed by blunt force trauma and a stab wound to the heart. And then Cindy shows up, pissed off that she wasn't involved in the meeting last night or the one today.
And that's because they were discussing the gambler who was stabbed, you know, like with a shiv.
And Cindy's line that those circumstances were completely circumstantial. I love that.
Yeah. What does that even mean? Exactly.
And then Beth again says, you know, the sooner we find the laptop, and then we will find the killer together. And then the sooner we can all move on.
And if you notice, as soon as she says the thing about the laptop, Cindy crosses her arms.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't look guilty, but that's like very clear body language of like, I'm trying to be protective.
Yeah.
And when you go back and rewatch these episodes, knowing what you know, that's so good.
Mm-hmm.
Just good job, Meg.
She is killing it this season.
Everybody is.
Everybody is.
Honestly, like someone will jump out at me as doing something really amazing. And I feel bad calling it out because I know that everybody else is doing amazing things as well. But like,
yeah,
I don't want to play favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't honestly have a favorite, but you know, sometimes in one moment, one character is like, or one actress or actor is doing something really amazing.
Yeah.
And it's just like, wow.
Yeah. There are so many moments like this in this episode. And then one of my favorite scenes here, we're back
me
at
too.
The diner and Marie is shaking. She's so nervous carrying this tea over to the shade. And he tries it and says, Earl Grey himself could not have brewed a finer cup. And I was so proud of her.
Yeah, she worked really hard, apparently.
Yeah, it took like 44 attempts, I think he said.
Yeah.
Which, you know, isn't too bad.
I think it kind of also gives us a little bit of a timeline.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like, maybe he has been in town for a month and a half.
All right. And then Sylvester and Pat enter. And I just love the imagery here. Of Sylvester like towering over Pat. And I know that Joel McHale is taller than Luke Wilson, but just the way that they had Luke like behind him so he looked even shorter to the camera.
Yeah.
It was just great there.
I think I've mentioned this before, but however tall you think Joel McHale is, he's taller. I mean, I can tell you that he's 6'4", but when you meet him in person, he's taller than you think still.
Mm-hmm.
You know who else is like that?
Who?
Stripe.
I would believe that, yeah.
Knowing how big the robot is doesn't help you prepare for the first time that you see it in person because it's just so much bigger than you think it is.
It's got to be incredible.
And that's Joel McHale. I was astonished at how tall that guy was. Now, he is greater than a foot taller than me, to be fair. So, like, anyone is going to look giant to me. But he's a real tall guy, is what I'm saying. He's real tall.
And then just the body language there, that his arms are out, he's confident. Pat's got him behind his back. Him saying, we need to ask you some questions, to the Shade. And Pat's like, if that's okay.
Yeah, everybody's like really embodying their character in so many like really great ways.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the Shade like really not affected at all. He's just like, oh, this is boring, tedium, you losers.
Mm-hmm.
Sylvester's really aggressive. Pat's really just trying to keep everything easy and smooth going. It's a masterwork, this scene.
Yeah.
And I also love when they're replaying his confrontation with the gambler,
mm-hmm.
how we see it from different perspectives, or different narratives, I should say.
Yeah.
The way that Sylvester is assuming it was, and the way that the Shade is portraying it as it was. That's really great. It actually reminds me of Luke Wilson's episode of The X-Files.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
He played the sheriff, and as Mulder and Scully look back at their interactions with him, when Scully remembers, he's like charming and handsome.
Mm-hmm.
And the same exact lines are delivered in Mulder's version, but he's like a little hickish and dumb.
Yeah.
I mean, that was Luke Wilson killing it way back in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
And this scene kind of reminded me of that, in the way it was handled in different perspectives.
Yeah, he does. He admits that he went to go see, you know, that they met at that booth and it did not go well. And then he decided that he was going to go forgive him and goes to his trailer to say he was going to let the past go. And I also love the lines where, you know, when Sylvester says, oh, I bet you said blah, blah, blah. Shade's like, part of me with a little subtlety. And Sylvester looks like, says a guy who wears a top hat.
But man, does he pull it off.
He does. You know, they have their little confrontation. Sylvester grabs the Shade across the table. And then when they're leaving, after Sylvester has to tell Pat to get out of the booth, Pat apologizes. And then this is the Sylvester I was expecting.
Yeah.
That blows up at him, yelling that you're the sidekick. You are supposed to do what I say. I ask questions. And Pat's like, that's not how it's going to work.
I love Pat standing up for himself against Sylvester. Yes. Literally the first time ever, at least as far as we know.
That's what it seems like, yeah. And he tells him, you know, it's not about the Shade. This is about the town. You are scaring those people in there. And Sylvester, like, kind of flips and he's like, thank you, you steer me in the right direction. I'm going to go cool off. But his way of cooling off is going and taking Courtney out of school so that he could go train and level up like a video game, like Frogger.
Look, he's been dead for a while.
Only 10 years, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that seemed a little strange to me. But we also don't know, with the time vortex that was introduced in the Earth Prime number 4 comic, if he was affected by that the same as Pat was. We don't know what that actually meant. So maybe he came back in like 2009.
Also, just given his apparent age, which is to say Joel McHale's age, if he hadn't really played video games since childhood, Frogger would be the one.
That's true.
Here's a funny story. I remember, this was back in the early 2000s. I was having a conversation with a guy that worked at the movie theater that I worked at. And I remember him saying like, oh yeah, you know, kids these days, they're all wasting their money on Pac-Man.
Oh.
Yeah, he was an older guy. And in the 21st century, referring to kids wasting their money on Pac-Man.
So, that's hilarious.
So this resonated with that moment in my life for me.
All right. And then we shoot over to the art room. And I was excited to see Cameron back. And he is trying to paint, but his hand freezes up. And he explodes and angrily hits his canvas, throws across the room. And then Mr. Deisinger came back.
Yeah.
I was so happy.
He's got a cane, but he seems to be doing just fine.
I just recently was rewatching Stranger Things seasons 1 through 3.
Me too.
To prep for season 4. And I was like, I didn't realize that was Mr. Deisinger.
I did, but I didn't remember how much of the show he had been in.
Yeah.
He is an Atlanta native, or an Atlanta local.
Oh, okay.
So he's in like all the Atlanta stuff.
All right. And then we see Sylvester and Courtney. They start their training. And Sylvester explains, like, yeah, we were going to wait and do this after school, but now we have a killer on the loose. So you need to know everything now, because what if he shows up? And then we get a little bit of showing off with Cosmo of what each of them can do and flying around and that. And then Sylvester does this thing where his eyes start glowing and there's an aura around him. He flies in the air and blows up like a firework. It was very cool.
Yes. I love as he teaches Courtney how to do that. It really all comes down to happy thoughts. It's Peter Pan flying.
Yeah. Which is strange because Courtney embodies that so much. But from what we've heard and seen a little bit of Sylvester, like, they're very different in that aspect. And so I wonder, like, everything that is in Sylvester that he believes in and wants to do, that he's able to channel that same stuff. Because it seems easy for Courtney. She has all these people that she loves and they care about her. And
it's how she broke free from Eclipso's grasp.
Yeah.
And it makes sense that that's what the staff reacts to, because it's Courtney. And
yeah,
why do you think the staff chose her? Of course.
Right.
But we don't know what Sylvester's thinking about. He could be thinking about beating up his high school bully.
Yeah.
You know?
That could be true.
Or like all his happy thoughts could just be all the bad guys he's beaten up. They could be like really violent, aggressive happy thoughts, maybe. I don't know.
I guess that's true. Yeah. And meanwhile, Barbara is at her house with Paula and they are attempting to bake a German chocolate cake.
I love that Barbara's helping her.
Yes.
I love that they're doing this together. And I love that they're terrible at it.
They are awful at it. But they are showing that they care because they're putting the time and the effort into baking.
Yeah. It's like maybe we didn't use enough of something, or we put too much of something else. And just Paula going, it doesn't look like the picture.
Yeah.
Also, even if Paula were a great cook, this is not what she would cook.
No.
There's sugar in there.
Yeah, she would do much healthier stuff.
Yeah, there's so much refined sugar. There are carbs. It's bad times.
Very bad. All right, so Mike and Jakeem are in the bathroom at school. Mike wants to use the Thunderbolt to help with this whole murder thing. And Jakeem is like, but your dad said to only use it in emergencies. Mike says, did you see the sign on the door? Men, not boys. Mike wrote out the wish because he knows with the Thunderbolt, you have to be so specific of what you want. You don't leave any room for error. So Jakeem reads out, I wish to know the name of the killer of the gambler, also known as Mr. Stephen Sharp, formerly the CFO of the American Dream.
He was?
And former member of the Injustice Society of America. Amen.
I feel like amen was Jakeem's addition.
I agree.
Lest anyone think that they just made up that CFO thing from the American Dream, that was established in the pilot when Barbara first is getting the tour.
Yep.
So that's a nice callback to that. And, you know, why people at the American Dream knew him in the first place.
And it makes sense that he would have that job with his expertise.
And that's why that woman said he got what he deserved. Because he was a big old jerk to everybody at the American Dream.
Yep.
Until Jordan came back, I should say, from his trip of probably murdering people.
Oh, definitely murdering people.
His murdercation.
So the Thunderbolt writes the response on the wall in sparkly stuff. The killer has many names. And Mike is pissed because what a ripoff. That doesn't help at all. And he says, we need to get out of here before someone sees what you did to the wall.
Yeah. And on the way out, we do see that the door says boys, not men.
I love that. Back over with Sylvester and Courtney going to the Shade's house to apologize. And the Shade is like, why wouldn't I have just taken them to the Shadowlands? Like, why would I kill someone and leave them there? That's not what I do. And Sylvester comes at him like, oh, like you did with Dr. Midnight. And what about all the other ones that you killed? What about Jay Garrick? What about Wesley Dodds? And then the Shade comes back harsh, but probably fair because of how Sylvester's acting, saying, did Pat tell you about your funeral? And that's so sad to hear. Pat was the only one that attended Sylvester's funeral.
So maybe Sylvester treated everybody the way he treated Pat. Everybody that wasn't in the JSA, because those people were all too dead to go to his funeral.
It's true.
Also, quite shocking when he sticks out his hand and Cosmo flies over to him out of Courtney's grasp.
Yeah.
And he blasts the shade and Courtney takes the staff right back.
Yeah, she yells stop and Cosmo leaves and flies right to her.
As well he should.
And then the shade's like, okay, check with Maria. I was at the diner teaching her the art of tea brewing. She can verify that I was there. I didn't kill the gambler. And Courtney's like, okay, well, if you didn't, then you can help. So innocent and naive. And he said that he has other problems to attend to and then shadows off.
I think this next scene really gets to the heart of Sylvester and all his anger issues.
Yeah.
Basically, he was taking things out on the shade because it was the shade that told him how to defeat Eclipso by killing Bruce Gordon. And killing Bruce Gordon broke up the JSA. So when they came back together to fight the ISA, they weren't the same. And that's why they all died. And while he was taking it out on the shade, he really feels that he's to blame for being the deciding vote and going and helping to kill Bruce Gordon. So in his mind, he killed the JSA.
And why does he deserve to come back?
Yeah, it's not quite survivor's remorse. It's more like resurrected person's remorse.
Yeah.
Resurrected's remorse.
Yeah, something like that.
I mean, I know what he's going through.
All right, over at the pit stop, our favorite couple, Our Knight, is hanging out, but innocently.
Not a couple yet. We'll see.
Mm-hmm. And we learn that the timing of the hourglass is all off. He said that sometimes it's 48 minutes, sometimes 6, 17. He can't have a drop out like in the middle of the fight.
It's just completely unpredictable.
Yeah.
Now, last episode, we saw it give out at about 33 minutes, I think.
Yeah.
And so even if he were just half hour man, that at least is doable. It's at least predictable. But being unpredictable is way worse.
Oh, absolutely. And he says that especially if the gambler's killer is as strong as we think, you can't have that happening. So it sounds like he's not convinced that it's Cindy, even though he is hopping on anytime Yolanda says, oh, it's obviously Cindy. And then I have a prediction here.
Oh, go ahead.
I think that Cindy is going to end up helping him. I don't know if it'll be fix the hourglass, but I know in one of the Hourmans in the comics used, it was like a drug that he took. So maybe with her chemistry skills, she's going to help him to fix the hourglass so that he could have the longer or more stable timing. I don't know. That's my thought of where that might be heading.
Okay.
But the shade pops up here in the pit stop, apologizes for not being able to help with Grundy. When Beth says that you don't look so good, he said, no, I ran into something rather large and rather stupid, which I thought was great for him to describe Sylvester that way. But he wasn't letting them know that that's who he was talking about.
Right.
He says that he's leaving Blue Valley to attend to some things, but he just wanted to make sure that he apologized about Grundy. And shadows off with those green sparks again.
Yeah, those same green sparks that we saw last episode when he intimidated the gambler in the cafe.
So I'm thinking that whatever issues he's attending to probably related to that.
And I love in this next scene, Sylvester talking to Cosmo.
Yeah.
Like they converse even more than Courtney and Cosmo. Mm-hmm. Because it almost seems like he can understand what Cosmo's saying.
Yes.
And I don't often get that impression from Courtney.
I agree. It definitely does seem like Cosmo is reacting appropriately to whatever Sylvester's saying. And then he is interpreting that or understanding it. Maybe he does know exactly what Cosmo's saying.
Like how when he's flying his X-Wing, Luke has a readout of what R2 is saying.
Yeah.
I yearn to know more about exactly how the cosmic staff works.
Yes, I really hope that we learn more about that.
Because keep in mind, it is not like this in the comics.
Oh, it's not?
No, it's not. Like the sentient nature of the staff is new to the show.
Oh, that's like my favorite part about it.
Yeah, it's really great.
But as he's talking to Cosmo, he says, no, you were right, or go to Courtney. So you can see that he understands that he was in the wrong and all that without someone being there watching him. He's admitting it to this, you know, staff. And then Courtney comes down and gives him a pep talk and says, you know, Pat has taught me that my whole life can't be about Stargirl. You need to find a life outside of Starman as well. Blue Valley gave me a second chance. I can do that for you too.
And she's basically passing her season two arc onto Sylvester.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw how well that arc served her last season. So she's trying to pay that forward to someone who's roughly the same position she was in previously. And I love that. You don't really see a character taking what they've learned in a previous season and applying it to their lives and using it as advice on another person.
No, you don't usually.
So good, because, I mean, that's what life is like.
Yeah.
When you learn a lesson, you go ahead and try to pass that on to other people.
Yeah, exactly. We get both of them admitting that they don't think that the Shade killed the gambler and say, who else is there? And it cuts over to Cameron trying to paint at home.
Obviously, Cameron's the killer.
I don't know. I haven't ruled him out.
Who else could it be? Cut to Cameron.
His grandparents are there, and he says, every time I try to paint, it hurts. And they say, you're destined for more than art.
Greater things than art. This is a family full of hubris.
I am very curious if this is him just manifesting powers and his hand is freezing up on its own, or are his grandparents causing this? Like, from afar, are they freezing his hand whenever he's trying to do art to sever that connection that he has with his mom in order for him to embrace his father's legacy?
Interesting.
But we don't have much more there. We go on over to the ISA headquarters, where Cindy is on the gambler's laptop, but stuck on the password screen.
Yeah. So, obviously, Cindy's the murderer. Everybody agreed earlier in the episode that whoever has the laptop is obviously the murderer. So, Cindy's obviously the murderer.
I guess so, here.
Which really makes me wonder what the Crocs are nervous about.
Right, because over here at Rip City, Paula and Crusher are working out, and Crusher says it's only a matter of time before they find out.
So obviously the Crocs are the murderer. I'm just saying that for everybody, just to be clear. So I don't see some dumb article like Stargirl After Show reveals the murderer. No, obviously, everybody's up in the air right now. It could be any of them. It could be none of them. It could be a very elaborate suicide.
Could be a combination of them. I don't know.
It's Soldier Boy from The Boys.
Oh, that would be a much bigger explosion. He would not fit in on Stargirl.
No. Though, remember, Breck did try out to be Starlight.
I know. I think of that every time I watch The Boys and how I'm so glad that she's Stargirl instead.
Yes. So that's this episode. Credits roll. Mad Ghost. And now it's time to talk to someone I've wanted to have on since season one. I'm very excited about this guest. It is Stargirl's number one stunt double, Christina Baskett, who is incredibly amazing. And we're going to find out so much more about her right after this.
Stargirl After Show. Stargirl After Show.
All right, so Sarah and I are very happy to be here with Christina Baskett, the stunt performer for Stargirl, the character on the show, Stargirl. Christina, thanks for being with us.
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm excited to chat with you guys.
So I just want to start by asking about how you got into the stunt world, because you were originally a very prolific gymnast, yes?
Yes. No, we all come from different backgrounds and we all have our different ways of getting into the stunt world. So mine particularly, I was a collegiate gymnast at the University of Utah. I planned to get a normal job. I was like a broadcast journalism major. But then I actually got an opportunity to work in Cirque du Soleil in Las Vegas. So I actually kind of diverted to Vegas for a few years and performed in Vegas. And then while I was there, I also got an opportunity to work on a TV show. It was on ABC Family Channel called Make It or Break It. It was like a teen drama about gymnasts trying to go to the Olympics in gymnastics. So they needed like specific gymnasts, not necessarily stunt performers. And so I had some friends on the show. They asked if I was interested. I didn't know what stunts was at all. And I started working on the show. And then I was like, this is, you know, pretty cool. I really enjoy this. No idea what stunts was, but I was like, I'm going to give this a go. And I did. And, you know, 10 years later, here I was on Stargirl.
I do have to say this. So when I got the job working on Stargirl in season one, I was super excited because I'm a huge comic nerd and always loved the JSA. I was very excited to see the JSA. So I had really high expectations for the show.
Okay.
But the moment when I knew the show was going to be something next level special was when I saw the initial stunt reel for the show. I don't know what it would be. I guess it was like the preliminary, like
the one that we made.
Yes.
The stunt made. Yes. It was like a concept piece for the character Stargirl.
Yes.
So yes, the concept piece, which I love as well. That was probably one of the hardest things I've ever done. Was like 3 weeks we spent making that concept reel of just kind of creating and playing what we imagined Stargirl to be doing. And it is still to this day, probably my favorite kind of thing I've created with a team before.
I think it's made its way onto Instagram in the meantime.
Really?
But for anyone that hasn't seen it, it's really amazing. It's where the whole like usage of the staff and its anti-gravity properties all got worked out.
Yeah.
And Christina's just in the whole thing, just Stargirling it up. It was when I was like, oh my God, like this is good.
Yeah, no, I totally know what you mean. And sometimes it's hard to play, you know, imagine, you know, something from a script to imagining how it's going to look. And that's why we like to do that kind of thing so that everyone can kind of have an image and also, you know, get on board with what, you know, we want to bring to the table as a stunt team. And we were very excited that everyone loved it. I loved it. And that kind of set the stage really for the seasons and Stargirl as far as action design goes.
Yeah, I imagine that everyone looked at it and said, you know, no notes, because that's sort of what the whole action feels like.
Yeah, and some of it was so complicated and so hard that really set the bar. So we kind of had to stay there for forever, but which is what we want. You know, we want to give the most that we can. And a lot of, you know, what we did was really complicated and took a lot of time, but you know, that's, we, you know, I take pride in that and what we can bring to the table as, you know, in stunts. And, you know, we really set the bar high there, but we definitely stayed there and exceeded it, I believe.
And when you watch that video, it's like, there's wires, there's people wearing helmets and they're crashing into cardboard boxes. And the staff is like, just so roughly glued over the image basically. And it's still stunning.
It's my favorite thing that I've done, I think.
Do you have a lot of say in like the choreography of the fight scenes, or is it more of like you are told this is what you have to do?
I really think when we have a stunt team, that's really what it is. Obviously, you know, we have our stunt coordinator and we also have a fight coordinator. And then as the stunt performers, you know, especially when you get to a certain level, they really count on you. You know, when the stunt coordinator picks doubles, you know, they really count on you to try, you know, and put input. And we really work as a team between the coordinators. You know, sometimes we start with them an image, you know, of like a concept between the stunt coordinator and the fight coordinator work really, you know, well together. And then especially in Stargirl, the rigging team, oh my gosh, they are amazing. And we need them, you know, to be able to do these things. So between the coordinator, the fight coordinator, the head rigger and the doubles, we have to work to create this initial image we have. And a lot of times it changes, you know, based on what I'm feeling, or, you know, sometimes they have an image and I'm like, oh, I don't think I can do that. Like, I am not very flexible. So when it's something, I'm like, oh, I actually really can't do that, but I can try my version of that. And so we really, a lot of it, it comes from me of being like, oh, I don't think I can actually do that, but let me try it like this. And it kind of morphs into something else. So we really do work as a team to create something that may not be originally what we thought. And maybe it's cooler, or it's like we sometimes we scrap it and sometimes we move on. And we really, it is like a huge creative process that we're all involved with.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
And that concept video we talked about, they do something similar for every big fight sequence, right?
We like to do that. In stunts, we call it a previs, like a previsual, so that it can really give everybody an idea of what we want, or they can get, you know, like Jeff Johns or the director can give notes. So it is common in most anything, any like TV show, movie, especially action. It is very common for us. Like it is very common for us to do previs that we kind of work on in our own space, you know, like cardboard boxes and doing, we play the characters so that, you know, we can get everyone on board of what we want. And also get notes so that when we show up on set, we are 100% prepared and can ever, you know, we can make it as efficient as possible and try and get everything done we want, because it takes a really long time to do action and we want to do as much as we can. And we really need to be prepared for that. So doing a previs, especially for a lot of the fight scenes, is almost, we really need that in order to be prepared for when we shoot it. So it's very common in most shows and movies.
Now, you did mention being a stunt team.
Yes.
And does that mean that you guys are sort of a unit that goes from show to show together? Or is it assembled per show? Do you go where Walter goes? Or do you audition for each different stunt job that you have?
It depends. In the world of stunts, it is common for there to be kind of a rough team that travels show to show, kind of the key players. It's not like it's anything official all the time. Sometimes it is, like a lot of times, you know, like Walter and the fight coordinator. But to be honest too, it depends a lot on who's doubling, you know, if there's someone to double or what kind of role you play on the team. You know, so that's kind of to each their own as far as mostly the coordinator goes. A coordinator a lot of times likes to build his team. We were so lucky that on Stargirl, we pretty much had the same core team all three seasons. But a lot of times, you know, sometimes an actor or a stunt person is with an actor and they travel with the actor. Or a lot of times during hiatus, we will get offered other projects that take you out for 6 to 7 months. So you're not available. So, you know, it is very different and through the whole stunt world, but we were so fortunate that we basically had the same team all three seasons pretty much, which I think helps when we're all on the same page and we know what's going on. So a coordinator likes to have a strong team, whether or not they can keep it together, it kind of ebbs and flows, but that's very typical in the stunt world.
On Stargirl, are you only Breck's stunt performer or do you work for any other characters?
In Stargirl, I just doubled Breck mainly because she had so much.
Yeah.
But we do a lot. It is nice to have a team too, where a lot of the people can play different characters, you know, especially some of the supporting cast that may not be in every fight scene. Our other doubles, Kira and Lauren Kim, they doubled a lot of different girls. And that's, you know, to be a good, you know, stunt performer, it is nice when you're on a show and they can really plug you into any character and any style and you can, you know, kill it for us. And we had so many awesome girls on the show, guys too, but I love a good stunt girl team. And I was really happy that Stargirl had a lot of strong action characters that were female. And Kira and Lauren Kim, they were so awesome for a lot of the characters on the show. And I love that we got to have so many girls.
I have to say that during season one, everyone was like really excited. Like, you know, we got Arya Stark's stunt double here.
Yeah. I almost didn't do season one of Stargirl because I had come off of, I was on Game of Thrones for three seasons, and we had kind of just finished the final season of Game of Thrones, and I was gone out of the country for a long, long, long time. and I was ready to kind of, you know, take a little break. I really wanted to start a family. That was very important to me. And Walter called for Stargirl, and I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I, you know, want to go on to another long project. So I really was on the edge. And he goes, Christina, he goes, this is your character. He goes, this character was like written for you action wise. He goes, just read the first episode. He's like, I'm not going to say anything, read it, and then come back to me and tell me your answer. And I read the first episode, and the whole like scene of her working with the staff and like doing like gymnastics basically on it, I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, this is like, I was like, if I could write a character for me action wise that fit my specialty, and just even like her personality of Stargirl, it just really like, literally it was like written I don't think I'll ever have a character that is more like myself. And that doesn't come around very often. Like, this is it. So I was like, okay, Walter. I was like, you're right. I'm going to do it. So yeah.
Also, really, really great doubling, I have to say, because not only were some of the first leaked images of Stargirl actually you, mm-hmm. but there were a couple of times where I was going to say hi to Breck, and then she turned around and it was you.
I know that happened all the time on the show, which is good. You want that to happen on the show. It's funny too, because sometimes they wouldn't recognize me in real life because I have dark, you know, like dark hair. And really when we're not in costume or wig, we don't look like each other. But when you put the wig on and the costume, there were times too when I would look at playback and be like, is that me or Breck? And it was like a face shot even. You know, like kind of a medium sized face shot. I was like, is that me or Brick? But I mean, with the wig on and everything, we definitely were a great match. And people all the time would always say that or think I was her and then not recognize me when I wasn't in the Stargirl getup.
So you mentioned the wig. Mm-hmm. I told my friend Ben that I was going to be talking to you, and he was very curious about the wig. Okay. I think probably because he does drag. He's familiar. He was wondering if it was a lace front and who made it and if it was custom for you.
You know, through season 3, I probably wore like 6 different wigs.
Okay.
The first one was custom made, but it's a thing, you know, it is the wigs. First of all, Breck has very different hair as far as she has very like thick curly hair, and it was really hard. I think I feel bad for the hair team because they had a really hard time keeping the wig curled. One, because we were like flying in the air, you know, the humidity in Georgia. I would always end up with beach waves, which I liked, you know, it was cute. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, they had a hard time getting the wig curly, and then we had a different wig, but it was like too curly. And then, you know, so we actually went through quite a few different wigs. One, because sometimes it would just get thrashed with what we were doing. There's a couple times my wig got caught in the wires, which was, not good for the wig. So we went through quite a few wigs. There's like 6 different ones. I had my favorites, you know, but it's, you know, up to the hair team.
Is it difficult doing all those stunts with like the long hair? Because Courtney never wears it back. It's always like down like that.
Yes, it is not my first pick to mm-hmm. do, but to be honest, that's always how it is for girl stunts, I feel.
Yeah.
One, to be honest, it does help having the hair down. It helps, you know, hide a double. And a lot of times we'll utilize it, you know, to like kind of rough it up in front. And like, you know, a lot of times we're like, hey, like, you know, don't turn as far or like use your hair. So that usually helps. And when it's like flying in your face, it helps kind of hide us. But to be honest, it's never would I ever want to choose to be doing crazy fight stuff and flying in the air with long wavy hair just in my face. But that's what we deal with all the time. And it's one of the, you know, things we deal with between wardrobe and like shoes and hair, especially for girls, you know, that always makes things a challenge. But that's what we deal with on any show usually. And, you know, that's what you have to do to be a good stunt performer, is be able to work with all that stuff and still, you know, perform your best. So we're used to it.
Now, when you started doing stunts, did you do fight training as well to learn some of that stuff? Because looking at your stunt reels, mm-hmm. you seem to be really great at it.
I definitely had to do a lot of martial arts training. When people ask me about getting into stunts now that I've been in it for 12 years, the first thing I say is like, start taking martial arts like right now. I didn't when I first started, because to be honest, I didn't really know what I was doing at the time. And I just figured, I was like, I'm a gymnast. I'm not a martial artist. So I probably won't be asked to do martial arts stuff, you know, fights. All I did was get asked to do fights. And I was like, oh no, like, well, I better start training. And, you know, usually in stunts, you kind of pick and choose your kind of niche as far as what you're known for. You know, some people are really, you know, are drivers, you know, and dirt, you know, motorcycles, dirt bikes, you know, or they're extreme.
Horses.
Exactly. So it's like, you kind of, obviously the more you can do, the more you can work as far as, you know, what you can be hired for, weapons. And there's all sorts of stuff you can kind of specialize in. And, you know, mine ended up kind of, you know, move going from gymnastics to, you know, some like parkour free running stuff. I did Cirque du Soleil and I did a lot of wires work in there. So wire work definitely was easy for me to make one of my, you know, specialties. And then I had to start training martial arts because that's what we got asked to do. You know, it's rare to actually be asked to do like traditional gymnastics. Besides like something specifically gymnastics or a commercial or something, you know, it's usually going to be real world stuff and kind of moving that into fight scenes. And so I spent all years, you know, training in martial arts, and I still need to, you know, a lot of these people, the same way I was a gymnast my whole life, they were martial artists their whole life, you know, so I still don't consider myself a martial artist because I haven't put in the time that I would put in, that I put into gymnastics and that these other people have put into martial arts. But I've been fortunate to have a lot of good teachers and fight coordinators that have helped me look my best.
And luckily you don't need to master martial arts in order to like fight off five people, just to look like you can fight off five people in a scene.
Yeah. I have a lot of help from the other actors and stunt performers and riggers and camera. It definitely is a
team. Don't forget the editors.
Yes, the editors. Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah. It's a whole thing. So, you know, I try to do my part in, you know, training and preparing as much as I can. I did a lot of staff class in with my our stunt coordinator, our flight coordinator through Stargirl. I did staff class all the time if we had a minute. Lots of drills and, you know, basic staff work. And so, but it's nice because then I can put that into my skill set and continue, you know, and I also did staff work on Game of Thrones. So that kind of where it started too. I had to do staff training for Game of Thrones and then now Stargirl. So staff kind of, without knowing it, kind of became a thing for me.
So if they do Ninja Turtles again, you're a shoo-in for Donatello.
I mean, they probably aren't going to cast me to match Donatello, but, you know, that'd be cool.
You also mentioned wanting to start a family. Mm-hmm. And during season one, you found mm-hmm. out you were pregnant with your daughter. Yes,
I did. Yes.
How did that affect your stunt work the rest of the season?
Well, to be honest, I found out the very last week of filming. So I had like literally like 3 days on set where I knew that I had a little star girl coming, and I didn't tell anybody then, but I only had 3 days left on the show. But that was, you know, that was a huge thing for me. I knew what I wanted. So it was my plan to start a family. It was supposed to be before Star Girl, but then it was after Star Girl. And I was very fortunate to be able to complete Star Girl and then, you know, start my family. And that was what my focus was up until I was able to join a little bit later in season two, when I felt up for it and she came with me. And yeah, and so I have like a little Star Girl poster signed by Jeff in her nursery. And I call her little Star Girl sometimes.
Oh, that's so cute.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
I did remember that you weren't there for the beginning of season two. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that you were so great at it. I was bummed about it until I found out why.
Yes. No, I was bummed too. But Sydney Olsen came in and did some awesome Star Girl stuff on the beginning of season two. And I was really I was excited to get to come back and do more like the second half of the season because Stargirl is special to me. And so it was nice that I got to come in and do like the second half of season two and then season three. But I didn't know, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen once I had my daughter, but that's why it's nice too, to have such a great, you know, my relationship with Walter and the stunt team, and everyone was so accommodating to me and helping me with that, you know, that's a big change, you know, coming back in the stunt world after that. So I was very fortunate that everyone on Stargirl was so great and helped me through that, and especially Walter. So,
and has your daughter done her first double black backflip yet? Or,
you know, she is in gymnastics already and she loves it. No pressure on her, whatever, you know, she enjoys, you know, but I am going to put her in martial arts too. Since I've been, you know, doing it later in life, I was like, I'm going to make sure she does martial arts too, just because I think I find it so fun. But I'll let her do everything, but she is in gymnastics and I will say she loves it. And so we'll see where that goes.
Correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm going by a vague memory from pre-COVID. But okay, at the end of season one, I have some recollection of there being news of you getting some sort of assistant coaching position. Yes.
Gymnastics obviously was my life. I'm a huge advocate for collegiate sports, any sports, just the whole experience of competing in college sports. I just think it's amazing. So I always stayed involved with gymnastics in some way. And I was volunteer assisting coaching at Arizona State University, just throughout kind of when I was home for stunts, I would just help out. And I ended up taking the assistant coaching position after Stargirl, because to be honest, I was trying to find a more family friendly career that, you know, because I knew I was going to this. And this was too before I found out that I was having my daughter, because I knew that's what we wanted. I was trying to find a job where I could stay home. And like, but I ended up so I coached 1 year with Arizona State University gymnastics. And then when COVID happened and then I was having my daughter, I decided that it wasn't what I wanted to do long term. I'm still a huge fan and am close with the ASU team, but I decided I wanted to just be able to spend more time with my daughter. Now I'm just a little bit pickier about my stunt jobs and making sure I have that family life balance that, I mean, I'm trying, it's hard, but I can't say I found it, but I'm working on it.
But you'll be on Stargirl as long as it runs, right?
I mean, yeah.
You'll make that commitment right here, right now.
I mean, who knows? That's the thing. We never know, but I've come back every year. So,
I mean, that in season two, that's what Courtney was dealing with, was finding that balance, yes, of all that. So another reason why you're perfect for that character.
Well, it was written for me as a stunt double.
So how closely do you work with Breck? Are there any times where you're like training her for anything she's going to do on her own?
Yes, no, definitely. And this goes across the board too, on any show. We always try to get the actors in as much as we can. We want them to do as much as they can, you know, safely. So we always fight for time to get them. You know, I feel like in Breck's position, it was really hard because especially season one, in the beginning, we got to do a lot of training with her before the show started, which was really great because that was the most time we had with her. But to be honest, season one, it was really hard to get her because was in like every scene.
Yeah.
So it was hard to get her a lot. But we would try and steal time and make the most of it just to prepare them, you know, to feel confident in what they were doing. And we always want them to do as much as they can. So we will get any of the actors in to work with them, feel what they're comfortable with, make sure we want them to feel strong and confident on set, you know, and whether it's, we know it, we're going to be doing it, we still want them to be able to set it up and like make them look good, make them look strong. So we try our best, but it doesn't always work out just with scheduling. But especially with Breck, she's, you know, the star of the show. So she's needed. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, but yeah, we got her to do a lot of stuff, but like she got to do a lot of things too, like in Wires and where it's just her. So that was great.
I do recall somebody, I don't remember who, saying that Breck was like the most athletic of the cast. And I think she had done some sort of gymnastics at some point in her life.
I think she had a gymnastics base. So it was nice that it's always nice to have some sort of base with them where, you know, they're strong and just, you know, not, you know, there's a lot of things that come into play with it, you know, whether they're up, you know, she was really up for doing it, which is great because if they're excited about it, it's really easy to, you know, get them to try things that are maybe scary or different or, you know, a little bit painful and not in a bad way. It's just, that's the nature of it. You know, a harness is not comfortable to wear. Wires are not nice on your skin. You know, there's a lot of things. So if we get someone who's on board and game and wants to do it, to be honest, a lot of it is that if they're just excited and want to do repetition, because a lot of things there's no reason or there's no way they would have been able to do a lot of things we're going to ask them to do in real life because it's so unique. So sometimes a lot of it is just repetition of just getting doing muscle memory or like, you know, being working with the wire team and getting the timing right. Like so much of it is that. So the more time we can get and the more excited they are to do it, you know, the better the product is going to be for them and, you know, and the show. So she was always very excited to do stuff, which helps us out a lot.
Yeah. When I've spoken to actors about like their stunt work, mm-hmm. they are always like, oh yeah. And I got to do this thing where I like slid across the, like they get really into it and understandably. I mean, there was a point in my life where I thought I wanted to be a stunt performer because mm-hmm. I had spent high school doing really dumb things.
Yeah.
Like crawling out the side window and into the sunroof of my friend's car as he drove 70 miles an hour.
Oh, gosh.
That wasn't stunt work. That was dumbness.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and we do that kind of stuff on shows, but we make it a lot safer than probably how you did it.
Absolutely.
We all want to continue to be STEM people and be able to, you know, continue to contribute to Stargirl and to other shows. So, you know, this, the smarter and safer we can make it, the better.
I mean, Jackie Chan has a story about how they do things in China versus here and how his head was between two dumpsters that were smashing together and they just put a little wooden milk crate to stop it by a quarter or slow it down by like a quarter of a second. And he popped mm-hmm. his head out and immediately just goes, the American way is better.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Yes. I have heard some crazy stories, especially back in the day. I do feel like, you know, with technology these days and just our better understanding of things and just knowing what can work and how and doing, again, like doing it smarter. I do feel like we're able to do really cool and big things while also making it extremely safe as possible, you know, and you know, protecting our actors and stunt performers so that we can all continue being actors and stunt performers.
Is there any instance where there's like a stunt that we wouldn't, like the audience wouldn't think? So I'm thinking of like on an episode of Nancy Drew, mm-hmm. they had a fancy car, but that car was CGI'd. And it's like, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you just have the car? Is there anything like that for the stunts where it's like you wouldn't expect them to have a stunt performer there, but they do put someone there?
There's so many different scenarios why we would use a stunt performer. It's almost like sometimes like when it's a lot of people, you know, you see something on a show and it's like, oh, that's so simple. Like why would you have a stunt performer? You know, sometimes it's like having insurance. It's like, mm-hmm. you don't necessarily need it, but if something happened, like you're going to be so glad you had insurance. Either where if it's, you know, the biggest thing is safety wise, you know, even if it's something you wouldn't think is unsafe, but we have a lot of experience with, you know, when there's so many moving parts, maybe it's to keep, you know, the camera person safe, or maybe it's a lot of it's awareness of like, you know, as a stunt performer, you know, we are professionals in filmmaking as well as just doing stunts, but it's like, we understand film, we understand actors, we understand what camera wants, we understand what directors want, we understand what editors want. So if it's more so of just having someone that they don't have to worry about, you know, maybe you know, someone, an extra or someone who doesn't have as much experience on set, or maybe the actor wasn't able to rehearse, you know, and there's some, a specific thing that needs to happen, like with camera or with something, one small thing happens to the actor, you know, of like a glass, you know, they get cut or they fall or they, you know, an accident happens. A lot of it is just for, you know, to be insurance and safe. And if they don't need the actor there, then it's just makes everything easier, or you take away that risk, you know, even though probably something won't happen, but we've seen it so many times where something does happen, you know, so it's hard to say, because it would have to be that a particular situation, but you know, a lot of it is because we understand too what they need and what's going on, and can make sure that it's going to be as safe as possible. And if we don't need to put the actor in that position, you know, we don't need to. But again, it's super situational. So it would be case by case. But a lot of times we do it just for, to be extra safe and just to not have to worry about, you know, little other things, that so we can focus on what the big picture is.
Okay.
It is worth noting there's a stunt performer in the JSA photo of the old JSA. Paul O'Connell.
Paul.
Yeah.
Yes, he was our assistant coordinator. And there too, maybe it's a scheduling thing that the actor couldn't be there for.
Lou Ferrigno Jr. was not available that day.
Yeah.
It was just a camera test day where we shot the JSA photo. And so it's Paul in there.
Yeah. You know, it really can be anything, any reason. But yeah, that's nice too, because we're, you know, it's like, oh, we don't have him, but we have the same size and, you know, look as it would be the actor. I've done like other things of just, you know, where the actor wasn't available for like the cover of a movie shoot, and they just superimpose their, you know, their face on me, you know, for, you know, something, because we're just a good match and can do what they need to do. And, you know, so you just gotta make it work.
And they have camera doubles for that stuff too. All the family photos of Jordan and Cameron McKent, that is not Neil Jackson. That is his camera double. And I had to Photoshop Neil Jackson's face onto them.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't even know that. Good Photoshop work.
Yeah. Neil showed the young Cameron those photos and he went, "Wait, you weren't there that day."
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. I didn't even know that.
Do you, I don't know how to say this, when you want to brag about yourself, what roles do you like, I was Arya Stark or I'm Stargirl, like what's your go-to for bragging about how awesome you are?
I mean, I would say that, I mean, my two favorite things I've done is Game of Thrones and Stargirl. I mean, Game of Thrones was just like an awesome experience. It's just it's a massive show, massive production. You know, it was a amazing experience to work on. And I mean, everyone knows Game of Thrones, you know, and that one for sure. But I feel like Stargirl is my favorite stunts I've done. As far as like my favorite stunts are all Stargirl stunts that I've done in my 12-year career.
Oh, wow.
Like as far as like the, you know, it was very hard. Stargirl challenged me more than any job I've done. There's been some other challenging ones. Like I've done like some really hard, you know, very like specific styles of martial art fighting with weapons. You know, that's hard because that's not my specialty, but Stargirl is my specialty, like wires and gymnastics. And it was still the most challenging thing I've done ever, really. As far as this type of stuff, we were doing like movie style fights and gags like every week on season one of Stargirl. Like we on Game of Thrones, we'd have like 3 months to prepare like fights. We had like maybe a week or two to prepare stuff for Stargirl, and they were so hard and complicated. It was the most challenging thing I've ever done. And that's even in my wheelhouse, you know? So that's, I mean, saying something on the type of stuff we did on Stargirl.
You know, it honestly upsets me because when a show like Daredevil comes out, people are talking endlessly about those fight sequences, and rightfully so. Mm-hmm. But Stargirl, every fight sequence is incredible. It is far beyond anything else on the CW.
Yes.
And it's just, like you said, it's cinematic quality fight sequences. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't get the press and the buzz that other shows do. And I don't know why. Like, the people that should be like gushing about this stuff are not watching the show apparently, and they need to be, and then they need to gush because
yes, I agree.
it's all really incredible. It is,
yeah,
just fantastic. Like everybody that watches the show is endlessly impressed by these sequences.
And that's Walter for you. He is the most talented person I've worked with. And he pushes the envelope and he wants to do things that no one's ever done. And he will take the time and the effort to do that when other people don't or just accept something, you know, but he is so creative. We work extremely hard that, and he has very high expectations. So we have to, you know, he built a team that will push the limit for him. And, you know, that's Walter. And to be honest, I feel like sometimes I'll watch stuff and I'll be like, that looks fake. Like there's like no way that we did that. Like a lot of times where if I watch a show, sometimes I'll be like, oh, that was probably CGI. Like that was probably a CGI person. And sometimes I'm like, that looks like a CGI person. Cause it's like, it doesn't look possible. And we do like weird, crazy, impossible things in real life that sometimes I'm probably like, people are probably like, that's, you know, that's probably a CGI person. When I'm like, no, that is like a real, that is real.
The show does employ digi doubles,
mm-hmm.
but I can't really think of any times where I've seen one. Can you tell us when a digi double would be used instead of a stunt performer on Stargirl?
A lot of times it's more when like she's flying on the staff doing like, you know, kind of but once she like is on the ground, like takes off on her staff and then is just like a little person, you know, kind of flying around on the staff. But it's too, we also do like a lot of reference footage for that too, you know, to make it easier for them to do that. But to be honest, I feel like it's mostly flying stuff where it's just, we don't have the space to do it, you know, or that it's just, you know, easier to do with digi when they're that small and stuff. But to be honest, I feel like that's kind of the only time we use digi double is flying.
Yeah. You know, other shows, their digi doubles get close-ups. And it's,
yeah,
it's always painfully obvious to me. And I don't know why they do it.
Yeah.
I also, I'm going to put a spoiler out here.
Okay.
Because this is the end of our coverage for episode two. Mm. But in episode three.
Yeah.
You're actually in the episode with lines.
I know.
You're still playing Courtney, but a different Courtney.
Is my name Courtney? Oh, don't I have a Courtney name tag?
You do. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, it was funny. And yes, I do play myself. I haven't seen it. What's funny to me as a stunt performer is a lot of times we like do little things like that where, you know, we play ourselves or we, you know, do little small acting bits. And all of those things is what my like, what people will say, they're like, oh my gosh, I saw you in the show. Or I'm like, oh, I saw you on Scandal. I saw you doing this and this. And it's like the one thing people actually see you doing when it's like all these other crazy things that you'll never get recognized for, you know, doing that. It's like all the, these little things will be like, oh my gosh, they'll be like, oh, I saw you on Stargirl as an actor. Well, that's what people will recognize you from or do or say, all my friends and family. But when they don't know all the other things that you've done in your whole career. So I'm sure I'll get some people that would be like, oh my gosh, I saw you there, you know, playing the, oh wait, I won't say what it was, but.
It's not the biggest spoiler, but.
Yeah.
Everyone have a lookout for Christina in episode three.
Yes. But I won't look like the star girl that I usually look like with the long blonde curly wig.
And you also had an on-camera role in Game of Thrones, though less recognizable.
Yes, I did play a child of the forest in Game of Thrones as well. Season six. Yeah. But yeah, that definitely doesn't look like me at all with all the prosthetics.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I've tried to figure out which one was you and I don't know that I got it right.
That's okay. Yeah, it is. That's a strange one as far as we definitely don't look like humans, obviously. But this kind of stuff too, I love like on working on shows or you know, kind of just the behind the scenes things that nobody else knows. Like, I feel, you know, it'd be fun when I have like a little silly little cameo in this episode, and like everyone on that has worked on Stargirl, you know, knows who I am. And it will be like, no one watching the show that's not worked on the show will even think twice about it. But I, you know, I feel like everyone who's worked on the show, especially all three seasons, will be like, oh my gosh, like how silly is that, that that's Christina. And that's what I love about the, you know, shows like these little things that we'll notice and know that like nobody else will know.
Yeah. That was my reaction. Like, yeah, I had no idea it was in there. Or that, yeah, or that you were doing that. And then like, I just see you on screen. I was like, oh, ha, that's awesome.
I know. And I feel like everyone that works in the show will be like, will say, have that same reaction, be like, oh my God, like how silly is that? But yeah, it's because it was Walter's episode.
Yeah, of course.
Typical day on set. Are you like, if they're filming, are you always there? Like, are you just always around, like with the stunt team coordinating stuff?
We are always there, whether you see us or not. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we kind of have our own stunt space. So, you know, so a lot of times we won't see the crew, for a bit if we're not, you know, depending what kind of action are in that episode. But, you know, we are always there and we're always working in our space, whether we're creating, you know, action designing for prior episodes, like we're working on multiple episodes at once, you know, kind of what we can prepare for, trying to get actor trainings in. We have to dial in each character in the fight scenes of wire work, you know, we're pre-vising, you know, or else, you know, we practice in our rehearsal space. And then a lot of times, like on scenes, we'll practice in the space. Like if it's on location or on stages, we need to rig all of our wire work. We rehearse everything in the space to make sure it works or to dial in anything so that literally on the day we are ready to go and hopefully, you know, as nail it as close as we can every time. So that's a lot of repetition in our space on location. We know we try to be as prepared as possible. If we can get the actors in the location too, we try and do that. So it takes a lot of time to, it takes a lot of time for the creation design and like perfecting everything, especially when it comes to like wire work and stuff, which is, I would say 90% of what we do on Stargirl is wires. And that takes so long. You know, it's not just fight, you know, beats we can, you know, rehearse anywhere. We have to have all of our gear and like transport all of our gear, and it's a lot. So we are always there working on either that, or sometimes we have a team that's rehearsing, you know, while some people are on set, either doing stunts or like watching, you know, helping actor action. So a lot of times we're spread out, but we know the drill and we, you know, all have our jobs and we are either helping or on the wire, teaching actors. It's a lot, but it's fun. That's what I like about it.
In terms of working with actors, body language is definitely a thing. Mm-hmm. How are you guys matching your body language? Are you trying to match theirs? Are they trying to match yours? Are you coming up with it together?
It just depends if there's like a specific quirk or something to that person, you know, we'll try to match that. It's helpful in like a superhero show because everyone is super really, so they're pretty probably strong and athletic. So to be honest, a lot of times it isn't as difficult in like an action film because it's like, you know, everyone is strong and like, you know, if anything we want, we're trying to get the actors to look, you know, really strong. And so, but of course, if there's like a specific thing the character does, you know, we need to change that for ourselves. But overall, for the most part, usually if it's like super action based, you know, it's mostly athleticism but you know, sometimes there are times when it's like, oh, you know, this person is learning. So it's like, we can't make it look too good. You know, or if it's like, don't make your, you know, it look that perfect, you know, make it a little rougher. But, and that's more like kind of director Walter decision and, you know, trying to more like storyline stuff. It's case by case, but I feel like superhero stuff, we're pretty safe in that, like, it's going to be, you know, just like athletic and, you know, however we can do it, looking strong and yeah.
Now, can you take us through just a basic, Not super detailed, don't kill yourself, but a basic sort of progression of starting with your stunt design and all the way up until actually shooting it?
Gosh, it's hard because they're all so different. But I would say, you know, say kind of like I'm trying to just think of like maybe a specific one. It's hard because we go like really, we go piece by piece, like depending on, you know, I will say maybe if there's something with two different characters, like in a fight scene, like, oh, okay. So I like the fight scenes we did with Breck and Meg, and what is her character name?
Shiv.
Yeah, Cindy. I really enjoyed those fight scenes we did in season one. We had a couple of them, you know, where there's the kind of the two girls fighting.
And that was Lauren Kim doubling.
Lauren Kim. She's amazing. We did this one. I'm just thinking of this one particular stunt. We did this one stunt where we're fighting in the bedroom. She gets thrown out of the bedroom, and then we're in the street and we do this like jump and where we like clash together and then like come down on one side of the ground. That was probably one of the most complicated wire rigs I've ever seen. We come up with the idea. It's like, okay, so these characters are facing off and they're going to jump in the air and they're going to clash together, you know, and then come down. And we did so much like creative design on that. I feel like I wish you could almost see the behind the scenes of what the riggers are doing sometimes when they're like puppeteering us. I think I have a video of like this, of us filming this, but it's, you could see all the riggers with it too and see what each were doing. But we probably had like maybe like 10 to 15 riggers like helping us do this like clash. And it starts with, you know, one, we are in our stunt space and, you know, one of us is up and we'll be like, okay, where Christina needs to jump up and let's work on this arc of like how and where they're going to meet, the height, the like how far she's going to travel, you know, and then let's try Lauren, you know, Lauren's side of it. It's like, okay, we did Christina kind of coming up and then it's like, okay, let's try Lauren doing it. And then we kind of like get a rough shape of Lauren doing it. And then, you know, then it's like, okay, let's do it together, you know, and see if how we have to make sure that we, you know, arrive at the same place at the same time. And then it's like, okay, well now it needs to be, you know, smooth and we need to stop. We can't like wiggle when we're up there, you know? So it's like adding lines of being like, okay, you know, this motivates them forward, but then they need to be stopped, so, you know, then they need to stop and not move. And then we need to travel them down at the same, you know, next. And it's like adding different wires for the different movements. And it, we kind of like add different lines. Sometimes we have like 8 or 9 different like wires attached to us and they all have different things and they all have a person is in charge of that motion, you know? So it's timing. Like we spend hours like making that timing of like, okay, they clash here and they don't move. And then the other person like is needs to bring them down, but they can't land too hard. We can't like break our ankles, you know, but we also need to make it look strong. So we spend a lot of time, like, you know, knowing how far they need to let us go. And then when they need to slow us down and it's like this crazy moving spider web. And then we get that done. And then we go into the street where we're going to be doing that. And we bring in cranes and they have to rig the entire same setup we had in the stages.
Because that scene was shot on location at a real house.
On location, on the street, you know, and then we kind of like go safety wise, like go for, you know, again, it's like, okay, let's do Christina and then let's do Lauren. And then, you know, we slowly amp it up and then we shoot it. But there's this whole like, oh my gosh, like trial and error and just working out all the rigging and then dealing with the cranes and trees and like, oh, you know, oh, they want it to be this way and not that way. And for just this one like thing. And then there's an entire fight scene. So we're doing that for literally every aspect of the fight.
The riggers, are they riggers specifically assigned to the stunt team?
Yes, most of them either are or were stunt performers in their career, especially to understand how it's like to ride a wire. Most of, you know, they're part of the stunt team, you know, so they're riggers, but they also are technically on, you know, stunt team. And most of them are stunt performers, but they are like that's a whole nother skill set too of wires and rigging and safety and literally they are what is keeping us safe and from not dying sometimes.
So you don't have someone rigging the lights and then going, oh, I got to head over to stunts now.
No, definitely not. It is definitely performer. They are always, you know, it's a teamwork with us and the riggers, and they are literally is a puppet. They literally are lifting and lowering us at the right time or pulling us. And there's usually multiple things happening at once of, you know, different lines. And they are a huge part of the creative process and understanding like, you know, how to rig, how to make it happen either in a space or just like how to make it design work and where to put us in the harness. And, than working with, you know, you can get really good with working with a particular rigger and puller. A lot, I feel like by season three, we almost tried to keep the same pullers with the same doubles, just because you can get such a good feeling of like timing and how they move. And it was really nice to work with the same puller sometimes. You can like build relationships that way. And the riggers we had on Stargirl were just awesome. And I felt really comfortable and safe with them.
Excellent. That's very important. It's, mm-hmm. it's an aspect no one ever thinks about. And it's not really discussed in stunts. Like those guys over there that you never see with the ropes.
Yes. Like we couldn't do Stargirl without them at all. Like there would be no Stargirl without the riggers.
Even when people talk about wire work, you know, they're, yeah. It's just like, oh, this actor or this performer is so good at wire work.
No, it's it's different too. It's like, it, you know, riding a wire, it's, that's what it is. It's riding a wire. You know, so much of it is, you know, you could be aware on the ground and doing gymnastics, but when you're in the air and have other forces, and it's a whole nother skill set than just like gymnastics or being in the air. It's a whole nother skill set of, you know, learning how to resist or relax, or like, it's a whole another skill set that I really enjoy it. Wires has become one of my favorite things. Some people, you know, some people don't love it, as everything in stunts, you know, to each their own, but wires happens to be one of my favorite, which is good. Cause literally I would say 90% of Stargirl is wires, maybe 95%. I think there were like in season one, and there was probably like two things that I did that I wasn't in a wire or something. And I was like, whoa, this feels really weird to not have a wire under my costume or something. You know, it was like extra baggy because I had no harness on. But so I would say like 95% of season one was wires for me, at least.
Yeah. I don't think a lot of people realize that, like, it's not just when people fly up in the air, but if they get punched back against the wall, they're being pulled that way.
Yeah. And even just for little assists that either make it repeatable. Sometimes it's literally, they just give us a little assist so that we could repeat it in enough to like do a lot of takes to, you know, to get it right, or for consistency with another person. Sometimes, you know, it can be either everything, or it can just be assists, or, you know, we use it a lot.
Cause you have a body, and bodies get tired.
Yes.
Can't just endlessly flip all day long with no assistance.
And again, too, like when you're doing things on cement, you know, and just for safety things. And if timing is off, you know, I don't know how many times we've been saved by a rigger, you know, if something is wrong or goes off, and, you know, they save us from landing wrong or hurting ourselves, you know, they are very, very important.
Okay. I have one last question.
Okay.
Are you aware that you have literally the coolest job in all of Hollywood?
I mean, I like it. So I think we have a pretty cool job. And I know other people enjoy it. So, you know, to each their own. I obviously am a stunt performer, so I really enjoy it. And I think it's really cool, you know, and I feel very lucky and fortunate to have found it in my life path when I had no intention to or no knowledge of it. And I feel so fortunate that I get to, you know, be a part of creating something and doing it in a way that is unique to me, and that I've gotten to continue to do something I've loved since a kid in a way I never knew I'd be able to. So for me, it's the coolest job for me. That's for sure. 1000%. And everyone, I feel like in stunts too, are quite like-minded. Like we all ended up there, either different or similar ways. And so I love the people, I love the process, and I love being a part of all the other departments too and being involved. So for me, it definitely is the coolest job.
I mean, I think everyone agrees that it's the coolest job across the board.
I think so too.
And I mean, back before COVID, when I was allowed on stages, went and I would just watch you guys rehearse sometimes because it's awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean, really is.
I think everyone always gets so excited when it's stunt days on Stargirl, that's for sure.
And I want to point out that a stunt sequence might take a day, or the larger ones, 2 days. Have we had any that went longer than 2 full days?
Oh yeah. I feel like one of the, like season one, I feel like we filmed, and we had, cause sometimes we have like stunt units, like second unit, or just like stunt units we did mostly on season one. But I feel like some of them we shot for like 5 days.
Because the point I was going to make is that even though you don't have a big fight in every episode.
Yeah.
And when you do, it's a few days.
Mm-hmm.
But you guys are there all day, every mm-hmm. day, constantly mm-hmm. rehearsing.
Oh, yeah.
And just so, so much work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All we are the always time. There.
All the time. Yep. but that's what makes the action scene so awesome, especially on Stargirl.
Yeah, they're really great. The design is great. The execution mm-hmm. is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Stargirl would be the show it is without that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really glad that Jeff like made a point mm-hmm. of making that action awesome.
I agree. Jeff was really great for us as a department and as a team, and was very supportive in more than most sometimes, which is really awesome to us because it gives us that creative freedom to really go big, which is really fun to just be a part of for us, you know, to be able to do, you know, push the limits and do really cool stuff even for us.
Well, in 8 seasons of Arrow, there's one fight that I can recall.
Uh-huh.
In 8 seasons of Flash, there's one fight that I can recall. And that was all CGI because it was a shark versus a gorilla.
Oh.
With Stargirl, every fight is like real yeah. crisp in my mind because they're just yeah. so memorable.
I don't even think I could pick my favorite one. There's so many that are so cool that I don't think I could pick my favorite one.
Yeah, they're all great.
There's so many.
I will say, as you said, the Courtney and Shiv battles... from season one, both of them are really great. They stand out in my mind.
I think the battle, one of the part of the battle we did with Shiv and Breck in the school gymnasium.
Yeah.
That was, I think we didn't even know what we were, that one, we didn't have a lot of prep time and we had like 2 days. We didn't know what we were doing and hadn't rehearsed anything because we were so far behind as far as the action. I think we had 2 days before we started shooting that where we didn't have anything down. And that was probably the hardest I've ever worked in my entire life. And we worked so hard and created this crazy Warner shot that I'm like, would take months probably on a film to do. We did, Lauren and I did it in like 2 days. And then we did like 9 other massive gags that we rehearsed and did and shot. It was like probably the single most like challenging week I've ever had in the stunt world on that scene, that fight scene in the gymnasium. And it turned out awesome.
Yes, it did. I actually got to go down there for the last day because it was the last day of shooting the episode.
Mm-hmm.
I recall because I was like, this is my last opportunity to tell Leah Thompson how awesome she is.
Oh, yeah.
So I went down there and I had to do that. I got a hug from Leah Thompson. It made me feel real
yeah.
good.
Yeah, that one really sticks out in my mind because of what we were able to pull out.
Yeah, it was really great. And you're really great. And thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, yes, thank you.
Yes, you're so welcome. I can't wait for the new season.
Stargirl After Show.
Sarah, let's let these fine folks know where else they can find us on this wide world of internet and podcasts.
Well, you can find our other podcasts on fandomlim.com along with a whole bunch of other awesome podcasts. I am on The Swift Review, which reviews the TV show Tom Swift, and then also on What's New Nancy Drew that covers Nancy Drew on the CW. And Sean, where can they find you?
Also at fandomlim.com. That's where all our podcasts are. I've got Table Reads, which we're just getting back into production on very recently. And in that, we read and mock bad movie scripts that never got made. But all, you know, big money grab ones. Things the studios wanted to make. Not something a writer was like, oh, I need to tell this story. And I've got a podcast called Gish, in which my best friend and I discuss... the pop culture things that have drawn us together over the last 30 years, which is hard to say out loud.
Where did that name come from?
I was joking and said that we should do a sound effect for the title.
Okay.
And he said, "Gish," which is from an old Calvin and Hobbes strip in which he's pretending to be a dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately knew what he was talking about, which is why Calvin and Hobbes is one of the topics that we discuss.
Oh, nice.
So that's where that came from. I mean, as soon as he said, I was like, yes, that's it. That's the title.
Perfect.
And that's it. And we will be back next week with another episode of Stargirl After Show. Until then, have a super great day.
Stargirl After Show is a production of Fandom Limb Media.